is Ann Wilson, and today is Friday, November 4th, 2005. And I'm sitting here in the dining room of Rosalie and Bill Savage. They have a beautiful home. And as Rosalie says, it's done in early junk, but I have to say it's the most beautiful stuff I've ever seen. Many things in here are treasured by them because it's been part of their lives. And she has redone a lot of this furniture, and it's very, very beautiful. It's a nice sunshiny day. There's a beautiful wedding ring quilt here on the table. And we're looking forward to doing this interview. I'm going to talk to Bill first. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Just fine.
Good. Bill, could you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in October 26, 1922. I was born right down in Lewis's Creek. Side of Lewis's Creek.
Okay, and where is that? In Chincoteague?
That's in Chincoteague, yeah. About 1.5 mile down from where we are now.
Okay. The Savages live on North Main Street, and in Chincoteague, we would definitely call them Upton Eckers. So, anyway, can you share with me a little bit about your family history on the island, Bill?
Well, my father was born on the island, my mother too. Mother was a Quilling. She was on far north end of the island, and my father was right along Lewis's Creek, where he was born.
Okay.
That is far as I know. Where I was born, I was born there and we lived there all our lives.
Wow. Now, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had five brothers, and it was five brothers of us and two sisters.
Okay.
The two sisters was the oldest, Ernestine, Louise, and then the boys, it was Robert, myself, John, Harold, and Terry.
Okay.
And I got a half-sister, too. I forgot her.
Uh-huh.
She lived in Charity.
Okay. And what was life like as a little boy here on Chincoteague?
Well, the way we had it, in summertime we were in the water half time. And I thought it was a good life we had. Wintertime we'd go on the glades skating, ice skating. And I don't know, it seemed like in the neighborhood where I was, there was a lot of children.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always some kind of mischief getting into.
Now, how old were you when you first started with your own boat?
Well, my own boat, well, it seemed like ever since we could go back and walk, my father had us in taking up oysters, culling oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And just about the time, we had a boat of our own about all the time. In other words, we used any way we wanted them.
And what kind of boat was it when you were
young? We used to call them bateaux.
Bateaux. Mm-hmm. Okay, what is a bateau?
It's a short bow boat.
Okay.
And a scow is a blunt boat, like curls up.
Okay. And what kind of things did your father teach you on the water right away, besides oystering?
Well, we oystered during oyster season a lot. In summertime, he had you... We were up by clamming, raking clams.
Okay.
And at a time, you could look anywhere and see 30 or 40 people working on the water. Well, that was about the only most occupation it was at that time, was oystering and clam and seafood.
Uh-huh.
Done a little fishing and stuff like that.
Okay.
Oyster, clam, fish, crab.
Uh-huh.
And then in later years come along, there's chicken houses going up here.
Okay.
Selling brawlers. And we got in that a little bit. Just small, because he had that for his mother and children to take care of.
Uh-huh.
He stayed right in the oyster business too, the whole time he lived, until he died.
Mm-hmm.
But he died young, 48 years old.
Wow.
Mother died. in 1935 until she was 41 years old.
Wow. So it was a hard life then?
It was, yeah. But we all stayed together.
That's great. Now, how did you motor these boats? I know I've heard of people sculling, I've heard of rowing, I've heard of motors.
That was the most of it. So, we did have an old engine, though, 5-horse Bridgeport. She was paying, so in the back was Gears. But that's back what it was in days. In a lot of times, it's sailboats or something like that they pulled it.
So they had sailboats here?
Well, they didn't have large ones, just small ones, but going off climbing or something like that, 14, 18-foot boats.
Okay.
Just sailing them.
So not many motorboats?
At that time, it wasn't.
Okay.
I remember when they first started putting automobile engines in, was old Star motor. They used to call them Stars. They come out of the car, their little four-cylinder motor. And after a while, I think we had a six-cylinder Chevrolet, and then they commenced getting Marine motors, right for Marines. And they had clutches on them. You come in, told them, I'll back them up for what you want to do.
Uh-huh. Now, what type of foods did you eat growing up as a boy? What was some of your favorite foods?
Well, we always had a garden in summertime. And everybody had done a lot of canning. Mm-hmm. With no freezers, nothing around. But they can it, and in the wintertime, and doing oyster season, stuff like that, we'd eat oysters and clams and fish, and it was always plenty to eat, because if anybody got hungry, they were lazy.
Uh-huh,
Because it was no bad way, but God's words, God had given it to us.
Absolutely. He always provided for
That's
you.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, how about the ducks and the fowl? What did you
eat?
Well,
we had a lot of them around, but I didn't do any of that when I was a boy. Might not until I was back growing.
Okay.
I started working at a gunning club. But it was a lot of them right in the creek. You could see it, because we used to have real cold winters, and it would freeze up freeze the bays over. And in that creek, sometimes there was an air hole, and there were ducks in there trying to find something to food.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like a lot of people just would shoot them right in them that creek.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't much trouble to get a fowl to eat in wintertime.
How about muskrat, eel, and things like that?
That was done eeling. There was a lot of eeling.
Uh-huh.
And then they used to have a lot of some of them would have they caught mussels around the banks, but I think that was done sometime. DuPont was making something like that.
Okay.
And we had bay scallops. There was a lot of bay scallops around.
Mm-hmm.
And that, dredging them in wintertime. They had little houses that they would open them. Some people would open them in their kitchen or anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were calling the night. And it was a lot of that in them days, a lot, but it seemed, I don't know what happened to it, but they just broke their scallops up.
Okay.
Now, what we said a lot of that was after eelgrass left here.
Okay.
They took the duck food away, and protection of the scallops was in this eelgrass, and after that had gone, the scallops left, or they didn't leave, I think they just caught them up, and they didn't spawn out, and had no protection.
Mm-hmm. How about crabbing?
Well, they done a lot of trot line, and I was one of the first ones brought a crab pot to the island.
Wow.
That was in 1946 after I came out of service.
Wow. So you were in the service too?
I went in service in 1942 and come out in 1946. I had to stay in. Well, I signed up for 3 years or until the duration of the war.
Okay, now who was that? Which?
Coast Guard.
Coast Guard, okay. Where were you stationed?
Well, I was right here, everywhere from Ocean City Inlet to Virginia Capes, and then I went on to a cutter after that, a Coast Guard cutter, and they turned her into a flagship. We had a vice admiral. He was in charge of all cargo on Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go from port to port, from Maine to Cuba. He would check things out.
Mm-hmm.
But most time, he'd either go in the plane, in a big car, but he didn't want the boat to sleep on. 265 foot. She was a yacht. It's the Astor yacht.
Oh, my land.
She was built in 1929 in Germany.
Wow.
And there had been a regular Coast Guard guy being in charge of it, and she rated as a full commander.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave Mrs. Tonneson the same rating, but they couldn't say he's in charge because he was a reserve.
Uh-huh. How about that?
He was the second in charge. Mr. Tonneson was on that.
Uh-huh.
He was first lieutenant. And Mr. Carlson, they gave him the same rating as the captain had.
Wow. How about that? Now, what did you do when you came back after your service?
I came back and I come into working on the water in 1946. And I think it was in October, I went up to a gunning club.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I worked there for about 3 months, and then I come back and home, and I always had something to do, working on order.
Mm-hmm.
Fall in, taking up harvesters in. It seemed like times I'd get through one thing, I'd go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was in 1948, I started going to Ocean City, working on a party boat on the beach. And I done that for, I think, 3 years. And then I decided I wanted to get in that business.
Uh-huh.
So.
How old were you then?
I was, well, I said, this was 47, born 22. So I guess I was 25-year-old.
Okay.
And we bought a boat together, a 38-foot Matthews. And I run her for about 5 or 6 years. And then I sold her out to Mr. Howard Murray. And I went working for the Griner Company.
Okay, now.
And they had a little boat.
Okay.
Just taking parties for them up there, to their people.
Okay, now who is the Griner Company?
That was Mr. Allen.
Mr. Allen?
That was his company. J.E. Griner Company was. They were in turnpikes. They built turnpikes, bridges, and tunnels, and worked over here at the base long time, runways. They don't know about anything. They didn't. They were civil engineers, but they'd hard contracts to do the work.
Mm-hmm. And where were they out of?
This crowd was out of Baltimore, where I knew most of them, but they had an office in Florida, too.
Okay.
Some of these would go down to Florida once. I mean, down there once in a while. But I worked there with them for quite a few years. My uncle was running that club. He was manager of this Pope's Island Club.
Okay, what was the name of the club again?
Pope's Island Gunning Club.
Okay, Pope's Island Gunning Club, okay.
Yeah, and that's right just about on Northern Virginia line.
Okay, and what did the Gunning Club look like? Can you take us through in our imagination and kind of...
No, it was just one... It looked like the way it was. It started out little on one little place. And then it built this way, one way, and then the other way, and putting bedrooms on.
Uh-huh.
And I have seen as many as 17 into guests. And it was 8 of us and 6 guides and a cook and a mess boy in the back of the house.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes on Thanksgiving they'd bring their children down when these families would, and that's how you see so many children around there. Sometimes they'd be all over the floor sleeping bags.
Uh-huh.
But they did. We could sleep 12 in there in the stores, and we had about 10, and we could 10 in the back if we wanted. And
mm-hmm.
Most time we had 8, but we had 2 extra. They were bunk beds, so
okay.
All of them.
Did they have like a big main room too or something?
Eating, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, we would always eat ours in the kitchen, we call it, where the cooks was cooking and all. But they had a dining area in there. And there they had a big fireplace. They were sitting in that fireplace. It was always something going on there.
I bet you heard a lot of stories around the fireplace.
A lot of stories.
Can you remember any of those funny stories? One that struck you?
Most of the time, I would get out and I would go, like, yeah, I go back to the kitchen.
Oh, my.
Sometimes they get a singing. My uncle, he sings. He buys two or three drinks and he's the bully of the time. Bully of the time.
Oh, my. So, these people that came to this hunting club, they were friends of the Griners?
Well, they were. We had everything in there from admirals, generals, governors, all. Anybody they were doing business through.
Okay. Wow.
And then again, they had a lot of their help come down at times, especially in the last of the years they did.
Okay.
Because I think they were running it, this club, their companies. It was about the same way with Fletcher's. They were doing the same thing.
Now, what was your job as a manager of the club?
Well, I was to see that everything went on in a gun, too. I went right out in a gun, too.
Okay. Did you take care of all the supplies and?
We operated. They were allowing me so much a meal, not a meal a day, mm-hmm. for each guest, and the same way for the crew in there.
Mm-hmm. And how did people get there?
Well, it used to be that you had to go over to Franklin City and pick them up. That's where the train come in. Franklin City, they'd have to take a boat and pick them up over there, and as things changed, then it got so some of them had their own planes, they'd fly into base, we'd go over there and pick them up, or sometimes they'd come down on the train to locate them, so we'd have taxis there to pick them up and bring them over.
Okay, but they had to get eventually by boat to get there, right? Because there's no road into Pope's Island, right?
No. Only thing, the last of the season, or last of the years, we had one had a helicopter. He could pitch right in the front door.
Wow. Do you have any movie stars that ever came to visit?
Well, it was one. It was not up there, but it was one came here. He brought him here early in the summertime. What was her name, Rosie?
Kim Novak.
Kim Novak. Uh-huh. And I think they took her out on the boat sailing or something.
Okay. Huh.
And I wasn't here that time. I was up at Ocean City working summertime.
Uh-huh.
Running the boat.
Now, how about you took care of managing the club, but you also, didn't you have another job as a hunting guide?
Well, yeah, that all fell in with it, managing that. That's the way I run it.
Okay.
I tell you, when it used to be so messed up and now you didn't know what you were doing. So I tried to have a little bit of system to it. Because sometimes the way it was, they'd come in nights and the cooks couldn't get to feed them before 9, 10 o'clock. So I kind of busted that up.
Uh-huh.
I had it come in, we'd eat in the kitchen 6:30, they would eat at 7.
Uh-huh.
Give them 1 hour to clean the table up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like that, your cooks weren't fussing all the time. They had to clean up.
Right, and that's important. Keep the cooks happy.
And so I had it set up at mealtime. You'd be there or do that.
Uh-huh. All right, and then after that, after they came in and had their meal, then the next day they would go hunting?
Yeah.
About what time?
And we'd eat at 6:30 in the kitchen, and they would eat at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And then we'd go gunning.
All right.
And even next time we'd stay out till about 11, they'd come in for lunch, stay out. Some of them would take a little nap, and we'd leave at 1 o'clock, go back, and stay at sunset.
Okay. Wow, so it was a long day then.
It was a long day. But the way I had it arranged, and we would gun, they'd go in on Sunday afternoon, and we would gun Monday and Tuesday. I'd leave out Monday with a crowd, Wednesday morning with a crowd, bring them home, take another crowd back up Wednesday afternoon, gun Thursday, Friday, and come out Saturday morning.
Wow.
And that would just rotate it.
Uh-huh.
Now, each of these people, they would have a week apiece, but they would make two parties out in that week, so
okay.
It should be changed like that.
And, can you think of any stories that really come to your mind, like the most interesting people that you ever met, or like the most dangerous situation that you were in with one of these parties?
I have seen them, so we'd go down and take guns away from them.
Uh-huh.
because they were drinking a little too much.
Right, uh-huh.
And after a while, it was a law put on that you wouldn't allow them to do that. So that busted a lot of that up.
Uh-huh.
Because I have seen people who go away with a fifth of whiskey and when we first started them years up there, we'd go out that morning, take stoves and cooking utensils and stay all day.
Wow.
And that was Mr. Fletcher's crowd. And Mr. Allen, they didn't want to do that.
Uh-huh.
And then, I don't know just why it was, but they said, well, I said, boys, you ain't going to kill nothing like this in a day. Sometimes they have a piece of canvas all up behind them. I said, how you going to get ducks in here with that can? We're after fresh air. But it was always something going on.
Uh-huh. Now, did you build the blinds for them?
We would build the blinds, yeah. The way we had the blinds in them days, we had concrete blinds. Big hole in the marsh,
okay,
and a big square 7 foot long, 4 foot wide, and have it, we'd go down as far as we could to water, you know.
Right.
I'd say we had about a foot and a half, maybe it was 3 foot down and 1 foot above the ground. After a while, we commenced using plyboard.
Okay. Wow.
And we'd go up there sometimes 2 weeks before and get our blinds and everything stuck up, all ready to go.
Mm-hmm. How long did the season last then?
Well, in some years, the government just wouldn't put so many days on you, but it used to be I would go up there right in the middle of October. Gone on up to 20th of January. That was a deadline. They'd allow you so many days, but you had to get it in by 20th of January because that's when the ducks commence to mating and get ready to fly north.
Okay. And what kind of ducks did you get usually?
Oh, we had black. Well, I first went there, there was a lot of eelgrass there. We had plenty of bluebills and canvasbacks, redheads, and about any kind of diving duck it was.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, when that eelgrass left, the birds left with it.
Okay.
Unless we had to bait them.
Uh-huh.
And we went and laid the bait.
Right.
Hope we had to do it anyway.
Uh-huh.
And that's why you had to be mighty careful what you're doing. It wasn't too bad at the start because they didn't have no rigs to get around either, the game wardens.
Right.
But after a while, when they come in with helicopters and planes, they land on top of you in the boat.
Uh-huh.
They go to see planes.
Uh-huh.
You had to be on watch all the time.
Right.
And especially when you got some strong, just like Mr. Buckler, he'd rather catch somebody and cause them trouble, I think, than anything else it was.
Uh-huh.
He'd go out and just blast them out.
Uh-huh.
It's like over there at this beach, he told him he was going away for that weekend. Told him that down to the fire company, where a lot of these boys, gunners, they went over there, they heard it. Well, boy, we'll have a time this weekend, he's gone.
Uh-huh.
He went to Ocean City and come down the beach and caught him.
Oh, my.
That's the reason why so many people got against him. That he was baiting you to go ahead and do it,
uh-huh,
and then turn around and then indict you for it.
Right. Now, were there a lot of birds then?
It was a lot of birds. Yeah, it was quite a few birds.
Right.
Because after that, we done a lot of black duck shooting and canvasbacks and. We call them dipping ducks or something. They can reach the bottom,
mm-hmm,
or something. But the other were called diving ducks because they would go all the way down 6 or 8 or 10 foot of water.
Uh-huh.
The diving ducks. But we always had regular good shooting up there.
Oh, that's good.
But you had to take care of it. Just like one time there, well, we were letting 12 come in. Well, we thought they would have 6 rigs out of shooting in that area. In other words, the ducks didn't really have a chance to pitch nowhire where somebody else was going to shoot at them.
Uh-huh.
So then we cut it back to 8. 4 rigs out.
Uh-huh.
And that helped a lot. It gives the place a rest.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you take care of all the supplies and do all the work yourself, or did you have someone help you?
Well, when I took over, I done it myself. Me and my helper.
Who was your helper?
My half.
Uh-huh.
No, I worked it. Instead of go have all of them do it, go on 2 weeks ahead of time myself, beside management, say,
uh-huh,
and get the work done. And that's what I worked at. Uncle Harwell, he didn't want to pick up nothing or do nothing.
Uh-huh.
He had to have help to it.
Right. Now, how about fishing-wise? Did you take fishing parties out of there, too?
Not out of there, no. Because that time, you know, it was in winter time, and the fish was leaving here.
But I mean the summertime, did you?
No, not out there. I take some of them up when they come to Ocean City. Some people that work for them, I think they let them, I think Mr. Grimes or Mr. Allen would let them use the boat 2 days or something like that.
Okay.
I'd take them a lot. And then a lot of times they'd invite somebody down, somebody that we're doing business with or something.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about, didn't you used to take people out fishing, though, around here?
Yeah, well, I did some. When I would do it, I always figured on being to Ocean City by the 10th of June. And before that, I would take a few parties here.
Okay.
And then I'd go on to Ocean City and stay the rest till after Labor Day.
Okay.
And a lot of times, I'd have three or four parties down here after I come back home. But they were getting so in that you couldn't afford hard to stay up there. You know, with just two parties a week, and I could get them dying home here, so I'd come on home and do it. Well, we'd do it most of the time, I'd say, through September.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me some of the stories. You've told me some stories about being on the water when a storm comes up, or, you know, with the eddy that you told me about. You told me some stories about when you were out in the boat in the ice. Can you tell us some of those stories today? I love those stories.
Well, sometimes you don't realize what you're doing until after it's done.
Uh-huh.
It seemed like these parties, when they would come in, if they come down here to Oro and they go to the house, they'd get the bottle out, I guess. And most time they'd be ready to go by dark.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of broke that up some. I told them I couldn't make it by daylight, go get a hotel.
Uh-huh.
And after a while, I kind of broke that up, so, you know, I get up there. But anyway, it was dangerous when you'd have 8 or 10 of them aboard your boat, nobody but you running there, and they want to get out and talk to you, and you're trying to run by the compass and time.
Uh-huh.
And I said to them one time, I said, boys, if you'll just wait until I get there, I'll talk with you the rest of the night.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I told one boy, I said, you might just go on the other side of that boat. I said, I'm not back to a pile of line. And that was something like 10 big piling stuck in the ground,
mm-hmm.
the bushes all around it. And I said, I got to go close to that because it's channeling very wide. And I like to see it. I said, if I run in it, it's going to be a good day. But I tell you, sometimes if you get aggravated, you wait down here till dark before they could go up there.
Mm-hmm. Then it makes it dangerous.
Mr. Fletcher said to me one day, I got him up there, and it was bad. He said, son, if I go across the ocean with you, I said, you might, but this is the last damn trip you're making me in dark.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's too dangerous.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
And like I told Rose about, we went up in them little boats. They would break ice, but we wouldn't put that big boat in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was leading them, breaking it because I had more power. And when you look behind, all this ice there, where you made that path, there she come together.
Mm-hmm.
Where she used to come together. And I thought, my land, this world, if we can just get in that clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, the engine was running hot. I was getting so much ice in her,
mm-hmm.
in her pump. And I got one of the other boys hit on that wall. And we made it in there just by dark.
Wow. Now, how about the story you told me about the day that Leah was born? And you were out in the water.
I was fishing, party fishing. Then I come in, I had good news. Wife had been down dock and told them, let me come to the house first thing.
Uh-huh.
I was having pain. Yeah, you were having
pain. But what happened to you on the way in, remember?
Well, there was a squall coming up. I heard that one day, and I seen this a water funnel, I'd call them, that's all watered up. And I thought to myself, well, I'll keep a right on in it. And I heard a boat on this side, one on that side, and two behind me. And when I run through that, the motor's run revved up, and that whole boat sailed right down. By the time I stood, I looked up, there was a foam all inside the boat.
Oh, my.
But it went back two or three seconds, and it was all over.
Uh-huh.
I had gone on through that. But sometimes when you sit and think by that, and sometimes I'd have to go up bay, and the tide was low. I'd have to go tour under Franklin City on up to the Merle, Virginia line, go right across that line. And I'd have to stand down on the side of the boat sometimes, still with my foot up high. And I hear this, they used to plant oysters up there. And there were a lot of stakes. Well, you couldn't see nothing, like it's dark like that going across that bay. Bomb by, I heard one coming down inside that boat where she was just rubbing against it, and it caught me in the pant leg and tore the pant leg off me. Or, you know, all skins off of it. And I thought, my land, how about that thing pulled me overboard?
Wow.
I said, it ain't neither one here, knows I've cut the engine off.
That's not good.
Well, that wasn't the water.
Oh, my. Wow. You were also telling me an interesting story yesterday about how your mom would take feed bags and make oil skins out of feed bags. Can you tell me that story again?
Well, feed bag, chicken feed used to come in these, they got them out in these bags, cloth bags, not grass bags, but cloth bags. And everybody was using them for something. Tea towels and Norse cloth and bed sheets and fella cases and everything. You mentioned even drawers. Underwire. And I told wife about it. I said, and one time, my mother, she made these all-skin pants for my father. Just saying, I guess she got pattern off the old ones, I imagine, or old rubber suits. But anyway, he dipped them back four or five times in linseed oil. They let them dry and dip them. Let them dry and talk about shed water. They shed water.
Wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Really neat. And that was before oil skins came in, the rubber.
Before the rubber come in, right. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
They were all skins, they called them.
Uh-huh.
So I guess she figured, well, if them people can sell them all, they'll be able to make one.
Uh-huh.
So she made all skins. Wow. And I seen her even make coats, same thing with coat.
And make it water repellent
that. Yeah, and dip it with that linseed oil.
That's pretty neat. Wow.
But that, there wasn't no stuff around then. I've seen it many times up there gunning. There was no such thing as insulated boots. I've taken newspapers and wrapped my feet up and put my socks on, wrapped my feet up in newspaper and pushed them down my boot.
Uh-huh.
Like, help insulate. Gets a cold. I'll tell you the truth, it hurt my hands sometimes. There wasn't no such thing at all as rubber gloves. Your hands would get so cold and wet, I felt like sitting right there and crying.
Uh-huh.
He said, Uncle said, beat them, beat them, beat them, beat them. He wants to get circulation going.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, it was cold times, I tell you.
Uh-huh.
But one thing, you didn't have the rig to do, gun in.
Right.
Just like
you had to
insulated. Now you can get insulated, everything insulated, you want it?
Uh-huh. Now, back up at the hunting place at Pope's Gun Lodge or Hunt Lodge, what did you do for water and how did you have...
I caught rainwater for years and years. We all had a back house that's what they used, and after a while they put a shallow well in there for just about flushing the hopper.
Okay.
But we used for cooking and washing dishes and everything at that time. Was rainwater. And then after I took over out there, I had them go with a deeper well. We went to, I think it's 195 feet or something like that.
Wow.
And we had plenty of good looking water, but when the send it to Baltimore and have it tested,
They said, you better drink rainwater.
Oh,
you
really?
Just use that for washing. It was just as clear as could be.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty water, but anyway, we still use rainwater for drinking or cooking with.
Uh-huh.
Use that for washing dishes, deep well.
And there's no electric there, right?
Well, ever since I was up there, they had some kind of little motor that charged, and we had, I don't think it's about 12 6-volt batteries. All right, that was the latest then. But later years, they had these Delco systems, but they were pretty good. They'd pull a light on, the engine would start.
Uh-huh.
And she was 5,000 watts, she put out, so you could run anything on her in the day. But then sometimes you have a little trouble then. People leave one light on, and a whole she'd run all night long.
Uh-huh.
So I told her, I kind of made a little roll in, 12 o'clock, the motor stops.
Uh-huh.
And she said, once sit down by the fireplace or light a lamp, do it.
Because
with that fireplace going, there was all kinds of lights. They were just sitting around or talking.
Uh-huh.
And once in a while, they wouldn't want to do that. And I just reached up there and pulled a switch. That cut all the current off.
That worked.
And once in a while, before I had that switch up there, they'd go out there, sneak out there, and start the engine again. I'd throw a switch out there, but they'd learned that one. When I put that one in the house, I cut everything off.
Uh-huh. Now, who did all the cleaning of all the fowl and everything?
We boys.
You did it for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was what we had around there. I tried to have it figured, so it's like where we had two parties a week. I would get by probably with two seafood some kind of way, oysters, clams, crackers, or something like that. And the same way, once in a while, they would want the fowl if they were killing a lot of ducks.
Right, and after they killed them, who cleaned them?
Well, they would take them home with them like it.
Oh, so you didn't have to do that too?
Not unless we wanted them to eat.
Okay.
Now, sometimes I got so that we just cut the breast out and I'll say brant or something like that, because they were, that bite all was good. And they put them in quart jars or something, sent them home with them.
Okay.
Just rough them right open, cut that breast right out of them, and done it on some, when the comments was loud on some geese.
Okay.
Killed a lot of them
uh-huh.
for 2 or 3 years, and that's the way to do them. And a lot of times I would fix that, and they cook it on that fireplace nights.
Oh, that's neat. Them. That's really neat.
Yeah, I'd take a little vinegar and a little oil, pepper and salt, about to soak 2 or 3 hours, and then
uh-huh.
use it in the fireplace. Just have farts, small farts or something like that.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah.
I bet they liked that, didn't they?
And to get at it, yeah. And that's like with oysters. Now, overnight, we'd open raw oysters to them just for supper. And then we'd have a little kettle of steamed oysters.
Mm-hmm.
No, two little plates of butter. They'd eat them steamed oysters with butter.
I bet they love that.
Half of them, I think that's what they come down for.
Was the food.
Food.
The seafood.
Yeah.
Because that was a treat.
Yeah. And I could get by pretty good with them on seafood, because I would catch the seafood myself, and that helped me out a lot on earnings.
Uh-huh, definitely.
Yeah, and same way with my wife, when she would, sometimes I think she canned hide 100 quarts of string beans or something.
Wow.
One year there, I think I raised 14 bushel of potatoes.
Wow.
And just kept them for herself and clubhouse.
Uh-huh.
And some of them, boys, I bet you're getting paid for that. I didn't say nothing. I thought, you must be dumber than I am. You think I'm doing this for nothing? Same way as all year, I'd go put an insight here, and I'd have some that we could bake them fish, have their baked ones, so sometimes we'd bake them. And other times I'd have some salted down, and some froze, salt them right off.
Uh-huh.
And that's just same as money in your pocket, in the bag. And I would catch, we'd catch clams, lay clams out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd pick up oysters from somewhere and have them where I could get to them fast. I'd lay $12 a bushel on oysters.
Uh-huh.
And I'd call them myself and then have a bomb. In other words, that would kept me in labor all the time. That's something to do.
Oh, definitely.
Well, wouldn't they have that big
garden? Yeah, that's vegetables. beets, carrots,
tomatoes, beets, string beans.
No, when Orville had it, he never raised nothing. He didn't pull or nothing. I don't know how he ever made a living out of it.
Yeah, what wage-wise, if I might ask, what were the wages?
When I first took over and I got Orville, he was only getting $100 a month for being the manager.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do nothing else, but I guess he got back the same salary we did as gunners, as a gunning.
So you got extra when you took people out?
Well, we got that regardless if we went out or not. We were there if they wanted us.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they paid me $4,800 a year at last for just managing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was making it off the grub, and then I was making $1,200 a month at gunning.
Okay.
So,
and then you got tips too, right?
Well, yeah, sometimes we get good tips.
That's really neat. Who was the most interesting person that you took out?
Well, an old fellow come down with the Fletchers. He used to be an arson detective in New York City, Stu Constable.
Mm-hmm.
It would always be something other. He'd do something other, and you couldn't help him laughing and joke about it. And,
uh-huh.
And nothing else. He'd have dogs in bed with him, but he didn't watch him, no. And if he had whiskey around him, he'd get drunk.
So he was a character?
He was a character, yeah. And he came down for years and years with the Fletchers.
Uh-huh. And what was he in? He was an
architect in New York City.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And he stayed there until he retired. And then he went to Carolina, where Harold Fletcher was.
All right, now you brought up another interesting point, dogs. Did they bring their own dogs, or did you have dogs?
Well, yeah, but Charles Allen, he used to have two dogs. He kept down here all the time.
What kind?
Black Lab.
Okay.
And they were good dogs.
They were good hunting dogs?
Good hunting dogs, yeah.
So did you a lot of time in the water?
Yeah, you had to hold them back, because times they see you getting ready to shoot, they wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
But they wouldn't taught to stay until I would say go.
Right.
But they saved a lot of work.
I imagine.
If you didn't, if you were in a pond, you had to get out in that pond, weigh them down. If you had this dog, you just go get it, boy.
Uh-huh.
No, it was that same way up there when we first started. If somebody had a dog, well, then you take a left, you take them. You had to take that boat polar off. They go on the deal sometimes.
Yeah, not fun. But do you remember their names, dog names?
I think, I forgot just what the dog's name was now. Because Charles had like three or four, and Arvel had an old dog. What's her name, bro? You remember? He's come right up to,
yeah, that old
I forgot what it was. That was a Chesapeake.
Right.
Okay.
It was a,
I can't remember.
A
Gunner.
Mm-hmm. But that dog, it wasn't much good for that. All he wanted to do was go and lay on the bank. And when the people would come aboard the boat, we took two people most of the time besides the man running. That dog had enough sense to get down. He push him over. He wanted room on that seat.
Well, he was like his master. He didn't want to do much. He made right.
That's right. That was Arnold's dog. It'd take a mess.
Oh, my.
But the dog wouldn't know it was good for his eat.
Uh-huh. It looked pretty.
I'm glad about it.
It looked pretty.
Yeah.
All right. You told me one more story. I'm getting to the end of the tape on this side. You told me once about a story where you were on the ice and you had you were leading everybody, and then you found somebody stranded. Do you remember that story you were telling me?
Well, I think that was when out there several times we had to walk across to the beach from there. It was a little bay in between, and I seen that ice, so we couldn't come down the bay. So we'd have to call the game reserve or something come get us. Or if they got tarred full with us, they'd have to get the Coast Guard, because the Coast Guard, that was their duty.
Uh-huh.
You know. And we were up there, somebody was out there, and it got foggy or something one day. And this guy, we went out there, and we seen him just before dark or something or other. And went and got him, and brought him into a clubhouse. he was from Greenback. He belonged in that and going to Greenback, but he was up at Arston or something in them banks.
Uh-huh.
And it brought him in. I think he stayed there all night anyway with us.
Uh-huh.
So the next day that Paul did left, see.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Gene Holloway, he was up there in Durham House one time, and Gene and Cleo and Bonnie, and neither one of them in very good shape.
Uh-huh.
You know, for as far as walking the marshes and stuff like that. And his house was on a little island off to itself. It didn't join the beach. In other words, for him to get on the beach, he had to take a boat.
Uh-huh.
And there he was, out there one time, and we talked to him on CB set, and he said something about the buoy boat was coming up the bay. She was in the buoy line over on the mainland, and they would pick him up if somebody could get them to him.
Uh-huh.
So I got that. We had a fiberglass a boat. I had, she was all fiberglass, and she bust ice.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in there and got them, and I told myself, I took them across the bay. I had some weight in her then, but it poor hit of us, and they would hold her down.
Uh-huh.
And make her bust this ice good. And I thought myself, after I got them on that boat, now you got to go back. And if anything happened, how would anybody get to you?
Uh-huh.
If you busted the fiberglass off that boat and a punch hole in her, you'd be in the middle of that bay, 3 miles from anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Say that again.
I imagine I would do that same thing today if I had it today, you know, go over again, because you don't think about that until it's over with.
Uh-huh.
And then you think, my land, what a dumb person I was being.
Uh-huh. Do you ever wonder, though, how you made it through the squalls and the lightning and the thunder and the ice and different things?
I had somebody looking at me.
You did?
Yeah. Man above.
You got that right. The Lord's always looked out for you.
I ran up and down that bay for 49 years.
Wow.
And never run to shore.
Never run to shore. In 49 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you have some times where you prayed a lot, though?
Oh, I did. I done a lot of times that. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times. If I could just see one little time, I know where I was. On the back side of the boat, there I was.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what were your landmarks? How did you know on the water where you were?
Well, I had run it so much, and I had run it with time. I used a compass a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I would know just about, and I tried to run the motor by the same speed.
Okay.
And whenever I got the head down, I kind of checked myself. Going between the Wildcat Point and Cord Marshes.
Uh-huh.
Right there. And then I could hold her just a little bit to the eastern. Because going up from here to Hedge Creek, just back northeast, would take me right over here. I'd head down.
Uh-huh.
And I figured by 12 minutes I'd be there. That is with a good, you know, 8 or 10 people in her, or 6 or 8 or something like that. And I would run our same RPMs all the time, like that. But I, you know, you get out there and everything clear.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in another bait. I'd have to do another bait, the same thing. I was just about halfway between there and Toby's Island. Mm-hmm. That's where I'd start turning. If the tide was up, so I could cut across that shoal, I'd clear up Toby's Island, where Warren Conant and them had a house,
uh-huh.
and go right on in. And how I would find sometimes if I was Toby's Island, if I tell them, turn that porch light on. And when I got, so that light went out, I was right abreast of that house. Because I couldn't see the light then, see.
Mm-hmm.
That house was cutting it off from me, and I knew just where I was.
Mm.
But I guess where I had done it so much, and depended on that compass and time, I guess that's it, because A lot of Richard, two or three times he runs sugar. Eddie Duke's run sugar.
Richard Quillen?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But Charles said, I said, he runs sugar, nobody right up here on this point. Don't down here on the point. We don't sugar. Nobody to the Magic Creek.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Charles, I said, anybody make a mistake once in a while? Yeah, but they ain't got to be drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they laid on.
Uh-huh.
And Eddie Dukes and Bob Jester was bringing Bristani down. He'd had a heart attack. And they ran shore up on Gilroy Point.
Wow.
By 2 o'clock in the morning.
And he'd had a heart attack?
He was having a heart attack. That's
oh,
when he was bringing him down the bay.
Uh-huh.
And I think they got overboard or something. And he got that boat off.
Wow.
And probably a reversal too. But they were just over too far to the western. They hit that shoal. But I have an idea. Todd was dying, and they had to go up around them two times. You know, you see me go a lot of times. But if you didn't bring them back over toward Toba's Island a little bit and get in that channel and come on down, because that channel wouldn't take too wide, I don't expect that over 50, 60 feet
mm-hmm.
wide.
And did you use scows when you were up at Pope's Island to yeah. take them out? Did you use scows?
Scows?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, we used them up there mostly. Until later years, because it's a flat bottom boat, and where we put a stool in it, it didn't draw much water. We could get in there with them.
Uh-huh.
But if you take a dead rise boat, like some of them last ones we had, well, with that dead rise, that's about 6 inches deep there.
Uh-huh.
And them stout, they're floating 3 or 4 inches of water. There's no way in them, see.
Uh-huh.
And we'd have. And some people we had would get wet all over.
Some people?
Rose, what are you looking at?
Well, it was just the sun on the water, just crept in, and all these crab ponds. And I said, I'll follow in your wake because I don't want to hit one of those crab ponds. Well, naturally, with me with glasses, and the water's just running down my face and right on down my neck. And he would come up to a crab pot. Well, he could turn quick with that steering wheel. But this old scow had been up there for months. And it was stiff, and I'd have to take both hands to pull it around. And when I got home, well, we passed somebody at, Warren Richardson. We passed him. I was coming down, he was going up. And the next day, he asked Bill, said, who was that Eddie Quillen coming behind you? Well, Eddie Quillen's 6 foot or so, a lot more than that. And I thought, good land, I couldn't see, but he couldn't see as well as I could. So after we got back, he had gone on ahead of me. He was going on in the creek, and he was still putting the boat away, his boat. I said, right up along behind him, I said, here she is. Put her wire when you want her.
You went high.
Yeah.
I think you went high, baby.
Well, he told me, he said, I'll find you an oil-skin coat. Well, what did he find? It didn't have any buttons on it. So he says, I'll fix you up. I'll get a piece of rope. He takes this piece of rope, ties a knot in it, and I'm going, and all this water just runs right down, right on down. Every time it hits me, it goes right down my face, right on down my neck.
Well, that's the I tell you, riding the main course,
you had to have good old skin if you didn't get wet. I've been wet a many times down my car, clutching my waist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that water would go right down here, and down there, the old skins went all over you.
Now, how long did you work at Pitch Hall?
I think it was 49 years altogether.
Wow. Now, who took over after you did?
Brother Harold. Well, they had sold out the land and all up there to Park Service, the government, and wildlife. But they had a 25-year lease on it. And about halfway through that time, Charles Allen kind of sold out to Herb Fletcher because his wife was having trouble. Oh, I trouble, couldn't see much. Well, they sold her big home and he went into a smaller building and stuff. And he wanted to be close to his wife. All of a sudden, you get down here caught up in ice and stuff, you don't know when you're going to get home.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to be close by, and they bought a big place up around Blackwater. just on this side,
Cambridge.
So he sold out there, and two or four of them had that there. I went up there with him, took them some stools one time, and he showed me all around. They were buying little ducks and raised them, growing ducks and flying, so they fly in the winter.
Uh-huh.
Winter time. But
has the place changed since you've been there?
Since I was there,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's coming, it's running down right away.
It is run down. Is it still there now?
Yeah, it's still there, as far as I know. I haven't been up there, but I understand it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like me that they knew that they didn't have too many more years and they'd going to have to get out. So I think when Harold went there, he spent about 17 years there, and he said,
wow.
Industries wanted to have, they had to give it up to their mm-hmm. time run out uh-huh. in 2002.
Wow.
But Terry and them, after I quit going up there, Terry and them, the boys, he'd go up there some, look at the boardwalk, boys, it's going down, and he said.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if it blamed it on Harold or blamed it on Fletcher, but he didn't want to spend the money,
right.
You see. Because he was a type that make out with this or make out with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Charles, he wanted to look as good as it. It's a DuPont's, because he would go to the DuPont's gunning clubs, and he would go to Al Decker's with Black Decker Man.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted his look right when he invited him down.
Right. That's good.
He was a nice man.
He was.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, I thank you mm-hmm. for your time today.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
I hope you... I don't know if you get that other thing playing. I think I can't tell you something.
All right.
Can you see the dark hours? Yeah.
All right. Now we have Rosalie. We're going to let Bill rest a while. And we've got Rosalie, his wife, that we're going to interview now. Rosalie, tell me where you were born and when you were born.
I was born Shanksdig, December the 1st, 1931.
Okay, and where on the island?
Right next door to where we're living.
And where are we?
On North Main Street.
Okay, North Main Street. And while I have you on a roll, you want to tell us the story you were just telling me a few minutes ago about you and Bill when you were out in the water?
Well, we were planting oysters. Or he was throwing the oysters out, and it was shallow water. And I was pulling the scouring for him to throw these oysters out. And a thunderstorm came up, and I was scared to death to be wading around in this water and it all this lightning flashing. So he said he would take me back to the scout. He took me back to the scout, put me in the cabin, fastened the door, and I only had one little window light that I could look at, and that was facing the other way, not where he was going. So I wait and wait and wait, and I'm thinking, what's going to happen if he gets struck by lightning? How will I ever get out of this boat? But he finally came back. He always does. When he rambles, he always comes back.
Oh, my.
So now the time we were up to the club. It was nice going up, but it was an awful lot of crab pots, and he was ducking in and out trying to avoid these crab pots. So when we got ready to come home, he said, that old scow's been up here all winter. I think you ought to carry that one home today. And he said, but I guess I better find a jacket for you, an oilskin coat, and he said, because you might get wet. Well, the only one he found didn't have any buttons. So he puts it on me, he yanks it around me, and he had no belt, so he got a piece of rope and tied it around my waist. Well, we started down the bay. He's in this boat that, you know, you can just flip here and there and everywhere and get around those crab pots. This old motor I had hadn't been used for months, and it was so stiff I would have to take both hands and pull it to get around and follow him in his wake. And every time, the water would just come right over me, right down my face, all down my neck. My glasses were wet. I was wet right on down. And when we got to the island, Warren Richardson was going up, which I recognized him. But the next day, he asked Bill, who was that? Was that Eddie Quilling? Well, you know that I don't resemble a 6-foot tall man. So Warren couldn't see very good, and he was going the opposite direction. But when we got down the bay, he went on in, and he was in the creek putting his boat away. And I'm going along slow. I come right up behind him. I said, "Here she is. Put her wherever you want her." I was wet all over.
All right, now I'm going to take you back to the 62 storm. You've told me some pretty neat stories about the 62 storm. Would you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I was working out at Betty Ellis' store, and Leo would come up here to Mother's on the school bus, and then I would come
pick her up. Leah's your daughter.
I would come pick her up. And Bill come in the store, and he said, "The tide's rising fast." He said, "The tide's coming in." I said, "Well, I got to go get Leah." He said, "No." He said, "Let her stay up there." So I called Mother and told her the tide was coming out quick, and let her stay all night. So I got home, and the tide's rising pretty fast. Well, Bill's brother Terry, he was up there to take care of his boat. Buddy Young was there to take care of his boat. And my brother-in-law, he lived with us anyway, Bert. So they all come in. It was coming so fast that they just all come in the house. They couldn't get home. There was no way they could get home. Mm-hmm. And they all came in. And the water started coming in. But they got the sofa up on some chairs. And the old piano got wet. That was no more good. I had to beat that up in pieces and haul it away. But it come in about, I guess it was just about ankle deep in the kitchen. But it was not quite that in the other room where we were sitting. And we would take turns. We only had one step stool. And we all had to sit with our feet in the water. But now our fire didn't go out, but the fan wouldn't blow the heat, see, the electric was gone. Uh-huh. But we did have a little bit of warmth. So we would take turns sitting on this stool to keep our feet warm. Somebody'd sit on a little while and then let somebody else. So I was sitting on the stool, and I looked. I said, "There goes the scow." It was going right by the window.
Now, where was it? Where was this house located at?
It was the house where Bill was born and raised.
Okay.
It was down in, on Lewis Creek.
Okay.
And they all jumped up and ran out the front door, and they caught that scow before it got away from them and tied it to the old building next door, an old storehouse. And the next morning, the tide was dropping off, went out of one room, but it was still some in the kitchen. I was going to fix breakfast. But Terry, he went on home. He walked on home. And Buddy, he didn't get home. It was rising so fast. Bill came in. He said, "We got to get out of here. This tide's coming in again, coming in fast." So we got scow. And he said, "We got to look for high ground." Well, we went down Savage Street to Bill and Mill Timmons. And when we got there, we knocked on the door and beat on the door. And finally they came to the door and we told them. When they looked out and saw this tide coming, they were shocked because they'd been sleeping downstairs on their hide bed. So right away, all the men started taking up the furniture and she started cooking breakfast for us. So when it came in, we went upstairs and it was just a small house. And we were all of us had on boots. And all the clothes we can get on. And I look sometimes, there'll be two and three laying in the bed together, all wrapped up with boots and all kinds of clothes. And then there was they had some kind of stool there that two could sit on back to back. And that's the way we managed. And Bert, he didn't have any cigarettes, and he liked to have a fit. He would look out the window, and his car, the water was right up almost to, well, it was up to the windshield. And all he could fret about was he had a carton of cigarettes under that front seat. I don't think he cared about the car as much as he did the cigarettes. So we stayed all that night. And I guess it started dropping off the next day, didn't it? Because I know the day that when I went out later that day, it was almost up to the top of my boots, but I just have shorter boots than the men. And when we got home, the kitchen door was off, and everything had been washed around, and we found things out in the yard. But Terry, he's come by,
and he helped clean out the stove and the hot water heater and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And we soon got some heat in there, and we had to nail up the, something to the back door because that was gone, but we could end that front. And as the water dropped off and we had heat, mm-hmm. it began to dry out. Then I had to beat up the old piano, one of those old upright pianos. I had to rip that apart and haul that away.
Oh. Now, how about Leah and your mother?
Well, when Bill, when the tide went down, he got his boat and he'd come up here to look for her. And this place was tore up pretty bad. And he couldn't find anybody. Well, he was upset about that, so he thought maybe they had gone up here to Miss Emma Jester's. That's on that ridge. When he got there, her son-in-law was there, and his wife and children. And Bill said they had tried to make a fire. What was it, real, a lot of soot and black and...
Yeah,
the stove of gas. The stove of gas or something. And everything was all smoky and black looking in there. So,
something like that.
But see, the helicopters had been coming over. And Mother and Daddy and my grandmother and Leah all went out in the helicopter. And they were over at the base.
Okay. So when did you hear from them again?
Daddy come home and he got his car. He had put the car up some way so that the engine didn't get wet, did he?
Gene Holly told me first that day after we come down. I come down from up here.
Yeah.
And he said they were over base.
They went out, they'd gone out in a helicopter and they were over to base, so that's where when we knew where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And, Daddy got home and he got his car running, and they had friends down Darty, just back of Akamak, mm-hmm. down from Akamak, and they were all staying down there, and I was worried about my dog. We had to have her with us the whole time, so he didn't want to fool with the damn dog, but he took her. Because the dog and him never did get along very good. Because she didn't like to take her worm pills, but he put them down.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts dining Connie with her. And I think he stopped two or three times and opened the trunk and let her get some air. Now, he didn't care about her, you know.
Uh-huh. But,
so when I got there, when we got down there, I think the dog was happier to see me than Leah was. She was having a good time.
Oh, wow. All right, now I'm going to backtrack. I'm going to go back to the beginning of your life. But I just wanted to hang on these stories to what Bill had.
Well, I want to tell one good one. In 1954, when we went up there and took them horses up, after granny season, me and you and family away.
Yeah.
I'd be over there, I'd come in at the other side of the woods, and she'd come over to that woods and bring me a Hershey bar or something.
Yeah.
All right, well, say that. All right, go ahead and tell us that so we can...
He would be planting oysters, and I could walk from clubhouse through the woods and go over there and take him a candy bar or something to nibble on. He was... Well, you were planting then some. I think you were planting some. Because if you were culling, I'd been in there culling with
you. No, you weren't in no shape.
Well,
family way.
Yeah. I guess I wasn't. I don't know.
And you hadn't learned how to call horses, did you?
No, I guess not. I hadn't learned that much.
So what happened?
She was
having a good time.
What were you doing?
Just walking through the woods and tramping all around, and I enjoyed the outdoors.
Uh-huh.
I'd rather be outdoors than be stuck in the house.
Go up there Monday morning, I work Monday and Tuesday, and we come down Wednesday morning.
Uh-huh.
Or go back up probably the Thursday morning, and work Friday, and come back Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it would be kind of rough, and we'd sit up on top of the cabin.
Yeah. But Major Allen told me that if you got the arc, you're going to stay in the house.
So that's what we did.
We had plenty of wood and plenty of oil and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, now go back to the beginning of your life, because I want to talk about your life. Your father was a chicken farmer, and what's your life like? What was like as a little girl? And
well, he wanted a boy, and he got a girl, and Mother couldn't have any more children, So I guess I was no more than like 3 years old, I suppose. Three or four. He took me downtown one day, and of course then little girls wore dresses and stockings, you know, they didn't wear pants, women didn't wear slacks then either. And he brought me home in a pair of bib overalls. That's all you could buy. There was no jeans, and it was bib overalls. And they were so big, he had to roll them up. He got the smallest size he could, but he rolled them up as best he could. And he got me a pair of boots. Those little red top boots, rubber boots, black and red. And from then on, I was daddy's boy. And when he went to the chicken house, if you got baby chicks in, the way it was then, you had to cut the box so that you could feed them around the stove and put the feed in the boxes. Mm-hmm. Well, when he would sit there and cut, you know, when he'd flip that knife, the thing would fly here and there and wherever. He had me running around all the time picking up the cardboard. And when he opened another box, I had to put all these things on the lid, you know, so that when he could take it all out in a bundle. Of course, when I got older, I could carry out the bundles. But it was always, he always had some kind of little job for me. A lot of it was for free. I know when I come home from school, couldn't play until the work was done. But Saturdays, anything, I usually got a little pay on Saturday. So, it was good in a way. And then sometimes, I don't know, it made me too independent. When he started paying me. When I got married, I couldn't get used to the idea of spending bills money. I felt like I didn't have my own. Mm-hmm. So now I have more than he has his.
Mm-hmm. Like how old
are you? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It works?
Yeah.
It works. Mm-hmm.
All right, talk more about the chicken farming. What was it like at that time? How was the business run? It's, you know.
Well, I think he started in 1928. Mr. Levin Lynch had started before that, and it was one of the hills. Was it Lloyd Hill?
Yeah.
Lloyd Hill. I think they were in it before, and I don't know if there was anybody else before that or not, but I know Dad had started in 1928. And then you had sand and in the pens.
Mm-hmm.
And you would go in when they had these coal stoves, and they had like a hover that sat over it, and these little biddies would go up under this hover, and that was for warmth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they first started, they put clean newspapers every day until they got big enough that they could take that pen out, you know, big enough to go all over the whole room.
Mm-hmm.
And they would change those papers. In the beginning, that's the way it was. They changed the papers then. And after, I think, 20 weeks in the beginning that they kept them? Mm-hmm. And before they could sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that was done, all that chicken manure had to be hauled out, and everything around here was filled in with chicken manure if you couldn't sell it. And then they had more sand put in, and you get ready for the next crop.
Mm-hmm.
The same way. And then when it was time to sell them, trucks would come in and they'd have their chicken crates, and when they set up their scales, Mother would be there with her notebook for the weights and the guy that was weighing, and they would take 5 crates and put on their scales. They weighed 5 empty crates, and then they'd go in and catch them, and then they'd come back and weigh those 5 crates again with the chickens in it. So they each one were keeping record, Mother and the man that was buying it. And after they'd sold them all, then when they would settle up, but then the way it was, you could pick your own biddy man, because it was so many places selling biddies that you could go where it would get the best price. In the same way with when you sold them on. That, you were on your own. There was no end with anybody else. No, you were on your own. And whichever buyer came around was with the best price, that's when he sold. And sometimes he made money and sometimes he didn't make any money. It was a risk. But he liked it. And he did it. And one thing I can say about him, we never went hungry.
There was a lot of families around here that didn't have hardly anything. But we always had chickens and ducks. When he sold them, if there was any little scrawny chickens left that they wouldn't buy, he would take them and put them in a pen where we had the ducks and, one time he had guinea birds and he had turkeys. But we always had food.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd go out here on the shore and get clams or oysters. And we'd always have our hogs, raise hogs.
Mm-hmm.
But as things changed, there come time, which he never would go in with anybody else, with no feed man or anybody. He worked on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But in time, they all ended because it was the chicken plant. Planters, a lot of them that had chicken plants, they were the buying, and some of them were, you went in with them or with the feed man, one or the other. And I think now a lot of them raise for chicken plants, don't they? But you could go in with the feed man.
Mm-hmm.
And it come to that, and I don't think he enjoyed it as much as he did when he was on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody overeat it.
Yeah. And he had always done things his way. And then he had to do what they say.
How long was your father in the business?
From 1928 to when he had that stroke in 72 or 73. I think maybe it was 73, I guess.
Wow. He was in that long?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But he always liked it when he was a boy. He liked, and he lived in this house across the road. He had ducks, had a duck pen, and he liked chickens and ducks. But I expect that was because he was up at Grandpa's a lot and stayed up there a lot.
Was the Grandpa's the farm or something? Or?
That was his grandmother and grandfather, and they, he had raised cattle and sold cattle, and then he would take hunters out in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to tell me about how we had such cold winters that they would hang their ducks and geese on the outside of their corn crib, or where they stored the corn.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd freeze. And when they wanted them, they'd thaw them out and cook them.
Mm-hmm.
But he liked to stay out there after his parents left up here in this house across the road and moved down on the corner of Savage Street. But he still liked coming up here, mm-hmm. and he stayed up there with them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed raising stuff pigeons and
nothing. Oh, yeah, we never went hungry because he had pigeons. We ate them. They were good.
Oh, squash.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have rabbits, muskrats. Anybody catching any muskrats? And him and Uncle Jay Taylor, they love snapping turtles.
Mm-hmm.
And if one of them got one, the other one would eat with him. His daddy found one, Uncle Joe would come over and eat.
That was a delicacy, wasn't it?
I guess it was to them. Mm-hmm. I guess I ate it too when I was little because whatever the game would eat then. But one time, the reason I don't eat eels is because one summer we didn't have much to eat. And he had eel pots set out here, and it was plenty of eels then. And Mother would say, oh, you like the eels like your daddy does? We're going to have eels tonight. We're going to eat dinners. Eels for dinner. Well, after I got a little older, I gave up on eels, and I don't think I have ever tasted an eel since. But that was when times were rough,
mm-hmm.
and we had to eat whatever we could get.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a many person, when blackberries rang, they sent the children out and went blackberrying. And what they had, that was our main meal. They cooked those, fixed those blackberries and put dumplings in them.
Mm-hmm.
Blackberry cobbler, they called it. And I've heard one girl say, my land, we've eaten that many a time, just made a meal on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you told me that the chicken feed came in special bags.
Oh,
some of the stories about they made out of that bag.
Yeah, those chickens, the chicken feed, it was cloth bags. And Delaware feed had a great big red D on it. Well, that was kind of hard to get that dye out. So what they'd do, they'd heat this water to a boil in the bill and put it, soak it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would rinse it and bleach it and go through all this. And we had everything made of feed bags. We had feed bag sheets and feed bag pillowcases. Somebody give you a pair of pillowcases, feed bag, they'd embroidered something on it,
mm-hmm.
a crocheted little edge. He thought that was the greatest gift.
And they were white then, right?
Yeah, well, after they bleached them out, they were all white.
Okay.
And they used them for dish towels. Just about anything. If your mother made oil skins for your father out of them, everybody used feed bags.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they come out with print feed bags, everybody thought they were rich because mother would go out and she saw something she liked. She'd say, if you're going to bring in and feed up this other house, she'd say, yeah, well, I need so many bags of this, this, and this. The men would pick them out, whatever color she wanted, you know, and bring them. And if she just got odds and ends, they would trade around. Maybe you might have one, and I've got two, and I'll trade you my two for yours or whatever. And that's the way they swapped and made things. Everybody had pretty curtains and dresses and aprons. And Christmas time, you got a lot of gifts like that were made handmade.
All right, tell me, too, did people come to inoculate the chickens, or did your father inoculate them?
Well, at first, you didn't do anything like that. That started, what, in the 40s?
Yeah. Only thing they had done that day was laxative, salts.
Yeah.
So they used laxative and salts?
Yeah, sometimes they mix it and made it in the feed, but they don't mix it down here.
Okay.
I think us times, I think they used any water, too, didn't they? Following them or some of them. That's where they used to have
the
little tanks off to the side so they could run that water, salt, salty water.
Yeah, they might have.
Epsom salt.
Yeah, I know we used Epsom salts, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it was in the 40s that they started vaccinating for tracheitis.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was vaccinated. Lillian, she was a catcher. And did Aunt Gladys catch with Lillian? I don't know. It was. They had three. You don't want to hear this. But they had three that were called the openers.
Okay.
They turned that chicken upside down.
Uh-huh.
And his rear end, uh-huh. They took a brush. Mother was a brusher. She got 10 cents more an hour.
Uh-huh.
And she would brush that on from them three. Then they'd let them go. Well, the catchers would have more ready for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the catchers got 10 cents more on the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of women doing that. And really, they kept on for a long time. With John Taylor's wife, she did it a long time. Years later, they were still vaccinating. But I don't know what for, because it's so many different...
Tracheitis and nothing else.
Yeah. Because mm-hmm. It seemed like after that tracheitis, it was more and more all the time.
Now, who trained them to do that?
I don't know.
There used to be a doctor come down.
Maybe, well,
feed company.
Maybe okay. He came down and showed
them. A doctor from the Delaware feed company.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's interesting. So that's how they learned how to do that. All right. How long did the chicken farm industry, how long did it stay on the island, and what caused it to leave?
I think most of it was after 62 storm.
Diseases.
And after the 62 storm.
Never traveled one house to the other.
Uh-huh. So it was so many. It was so many. Because everybody got into it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, I think, after that, if they lost anything, they just didn't bother with it anymore.
Uh-huh.
And the feed companies are...
Took over.
Chicken plants, they kind of took over.
Okay.
And then they have on the mainland... Long distance
forest. Right, so that kept the diseases away from me. So mm-hmm. disease was a problem. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting.
And today, I think everything is controlled by just turning it off.
Right, and everything then was done by hanging.
Everything was done by hanging. And when they first got those little bitties in, they put down newspaper, and every day they would change that newspaper until they got a little older, you know, and you could turn them out.
They had cold stoves. They never
pinned
for 500 chickens
in pin,
like.
Mm-hmm.
They had cold stoves. That's what they had. And then the hot box, they got up to all burners and stuff like that.
And it all changed.
Same way with
the
feeders. You had
to
feed everything by hand and troughs and stuff like that.
In later
years, you got these feeders that is...
Yeah, the feeders.
Right.
Everything's automatic.
Right. Everything is done by hand then.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then it was finished, you had to put water in the jar with a lid on it, turned it upside down. In other words, something better could get in there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From it.
Well, and
they got bigger ones all
the
time, and
it grows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the water fountains changed a lot, because when they were little like that, that was like those jugs that I gave Alfie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Daddy, he could.
So were they made of like porcelain, or
I don't know what it was. What was it made of? Those old chicken feeders.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah.
Water.
Water jugs.
Yeah, like jugs, right. Mm-hmm. Because
you, otherwise,
you know,
a lady
couldn't really
small
grower, or her, she couldn't handle it. No, but see, Daddy had big hands, and he'd get that finger around that knob, and he'd fill it up, and pick that saucer up, and he could flip it, and hardly spill in it.
Mm-hmm.
And me, I'd spill.
Then half of it. They came back with that screw top. They started off down home with them. Quart jar. And then as they got bigger and were drinking more water, they'd take that, put
them
into a half a gallon jar.
Mm, okay. Half gallon jars. And they had those little plastic things, you, the lid, and there was room, you know, for the water to run into it.
Uh-huh.
And that was, they done away with all those old heavies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they used glass, they go around restaurants, because Daddy got a lot of them. When I was working over to Dreamy, he brought them along.
Glass.
Back then, that was
pickle jars, and
yeah, and all those kind of big jars.
Okay.
Gallon jars.
They were gallons.
Mm-hmm. Right. Also, I want you to talk about the neighborhoods. What were the neighborhoods like at that time? How did people interact with one another?
My land, you were in and out of each other's house. If you planted your garden and your something of yours come up a little bit earlier than I got mine in, then I come over and got some of yours, and when mine was dying down, you come over and got some of mine, and whatever we had, we helped each other,
mm-hmm.
share.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the men would go to store at night, and well, that would be if they left home at 5:30, 6 o'clock, and they were home by 8 o'clock, and that's when the store closed, and that had been a long night.
Mm-hmm.
And the women would get together and put in a quilt, come over and quilt together. And around your neighborhood, I'm sure it was a lot of business, because that's a heavy...
Three stores right now.
Yeah, three stores, but they were heavily populated than we were up here.
Uh-huh. Because
it was only four houses here.
But you had to go to the store to get news.
Yeah.
And if the men was talking, they were either talking about crabs or oysters, whatever.
And seeds. Yeah.
So they were talking, the men were talking about crabs and oysters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And different things like that.
Yeah. And,
get him to sit over here with us.
Get over here with us. We'll let you sit with the women.
All right. And what else would they do?
Well, every morning you looked out to see if your neighbor was all right. If you saw anybody come out of the house, you knew that everybody was all right. If you didn't see anybody, when Mother looked back from Mary Watson, it was watch, see if anybody went to the outdoor toilet. And if they did, she knew everybody was all right.
Uh-huh.
And Miss Cleo, well, she'd have up her main door.
Yeah, she'd have.
We'd look over there. If we didn't see her about 9 o'clock, we'd go her up for her.
Yeah, well, she said she couldn't stay here as long as she did if we hadn't been here.
Who's that? Miss Cleo?
Mm-hmm.
Cleo who?
Cleo Holloway. She's got the beauty shop.
Okay.
And after Jean died and she had that leg taken off, well, she did well, because she would go shopping, and it was a struggle. Sometimes she'd take her cane with her, and sometimes she'd take me with her, and she'd have a wheelchair, and I could roll her around in the stores.
Mm-hmm.
And every day I went and got her mail, and she would open that front door to let us know that she was all right.
Mm-hmm.
If it was not open benign, we were getting uneasy, you know, kind of worrying about her. But she done well to stay here as long as she did.
All right, now I'm losing tape. I only have a little bit left. I want you to talk about Sundays, what you all did on Sundays.
Well, everybody cooked a big dinner on Sunday because maybe he had a daughter on this end of the island that married somebody down on the other end of the island, and you only saw them on Sunday, and they walked up here or down that way, whichever way, direction. So everybody always cooked a big meal on Sunday because you didn't know you might have company. That was chicken and dumplings mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes when you had hog killing, you had ham.
They had a little party with it too.
Yeah.
Oh, when they had a hog killing.
Sure.
Yeah, they did.
That was the party time.
Yeah, by the time that the hog was killed and cut, the men by then were drunk, and the women started working at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And Annie Holloway would take the hog's bladder, and she'd wash it in some soapy water, clean it good. And she'd take a quilt, chicken feather quilt,
uh-huh,
and put in that and blow it up. So then they got rid of the children because we played ball with the hog splatter. Yeah. Well, so you didn't have a lot of toys.
Uh-huh.
And you played with a lot of things.
Oh, that's neat.
If nothing else, I've seen the children take a stick and knock a shell up and down the road or a stone. Or
Well, if you find an old automobile, tar, take a stick and roll it all over land.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Pushing it.
And another thing the kids would do, if they could get a snake and throw it up over telephone wire. And you run around the island with these snakes hanging all over telephone wire.
And that is long rain tomorrow. That was what they're saying.
Yeah, that's right. It was supposed to rain.
I heard that.
I'm going to have to leave you because we're just about out of tape, but I want to thank you both, and I want to come back another day and finish doing you, or try to do another tape, because I have many things I want to talk to you about still.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, but I just want to thank you both for allowing me to come into your home and to do this. This has really been a joy.
Well,
and I love having all the stories on tape so that we'll never forget. So I just want to thank you.
Yeah, well,
all right.
We enjoy having you, and I thank you for all you do for me.
Thank you.
Taking me walking.